to be called by that name again. But the professor made no mention of Ian. He swung the car into a U-turn instead, and as they headed toward home, he asked in a tone of great reproach, "Why didn't you tell me we were going in the wrong direction?" Watching all the traffic lights on the street ahead of them turn green as if on cue, Mrs. Khan realized that his was a question for which she had no good answer. The next morning, Mrs. Khan was standing at the stove preparing brunch for their eldest son's visit when the professor came into the kitchen freshly bathed and shaved. He took a seat at the kitchen counter, unfolded the newspaper, and began reading to her from the headlines. Only after he'd finished did she begin telling him about last night's events. He'd asked her to inform him of those moments when he no longer acted like himself, and she had gotten as far as his lunge for the dance floor when the sag of his shoulders stopped her. "It's all right," she said, alarmed. "It's not your fault. But can you see me on the dance floor at my age?" The professor rolled up the newspaper and rapped it against the counter for emphasis. "And in my condition?" Taking out a small blue notebook from his shirt pocket, the professor retreated to the patio, where he was writing down his errors when Vin arrived. Fresh from his graveyard shift at the county hospital, their son wore a nurse's green scrubs, which, shapeless as they were, did little to hide his physique. If only he visited his parents as much as he did the gym, Mrs. Khan thought. The edge of her hand could have fit into the deep cleft of her son's chest, and her thighs weren't quite as thick as his biceps. Under one arm, he was carrying a bulky package wrapped in brown paper, which he propped against the trellis behind his father. The professor slipped the notebook into his pocket and pointed his pen at the package. "What's a surprise?" he asked. While Mrs. Khan brought out the Eggs Benedict, Vin stripped off the wrapping to reveal a painting in a heavy gilded frame evocative of 19th-century Europe. "It cost me $100 on Dong Khai," he said. He had gone to Saigon on vacation last month. The galleries there can knock off anything, but it was easier to frame it here. The professor leaned forward to squint at the painting. There was a time when that street was called Diya, he remarked wistfully. "And before that, Rue Katina." "I hoped you'd remember," Vin said, sitting down next to his mother at the patio table. Mrs. Khan could tell that the subject of the painting was a woman, but one whose left eye was green and whose right eye was red, which was nowhere near as odd as the way the artist had flattened her arms and torso, leaving her to look less like a real person and more like a child's paper doll, cut out and pasted to a three-dimensional chair. "There's a new study that shows how Picasso's paintings can stimulate people like that." "Is that so?" The professor wiped his glasses with his napkin. Behind him was a scene to which Mrs. Khan was now accustomed, an entrance ramp rising over their backyard and merging onto the freeway that Vin would take home to Los Angeles, an hour north of their Westminster neighborhood. Her boys used to pass their afternoons spotting the makes and models of the passing cars as if they were ornithologists distinguishing between juncos and sparrows. But that was a very long time ago, she thought, and Vin was now a messenger dispatched by the rest of their six children. "We think you should retire from the library, Matt," he said, knife and fork in hand. "We can send home enough money every month to cover all the bills. You can have a housekeeper to help you out, and a gardener, too." Mrs. Khan had never needed help with the garden, which was entirely of her own design. A horseshoe of green lawn divided a perimeter of persimmon trees from the center of the garden, where pale green cilantro, arrow-leafed basil, and Thai chilies grew abundantly in the beds she'd made for them. She seasoned her Eggs Benedict with three dashes of pepper, and when she was certain that she could speak without betraying her irritation, she said, "I like to garden." "Mexican gardeners come cheap, Matt. Besides, you'll want all the help you can get. You've got to be ready for the worst." "We've seen much worse than you," the professor snapped. "We're ready for anything." "And I am not old enough for retirement," Mrs. Khan added. "Be reasonable." Vin sounded nothing like the boy who, upon reaching his teenage years, had turned into someone his parents no longer knew, sneaking out of the house at night to be with his girlfriend, an American who painted her nails black and dyed her hair purple. The professor remedied the situation by nailing the windows shut, a problem Vin solved by eloping soon after his graduation from Bosa Grande High. "I'm in love!" Vin had screamed to his mother over the phone from Las Vegas. "But you wouldn't know anything about that, would you?" Sometimes Mrs. Khan regretted ever telling him that her father had arranged her marriage. You don't need the money from that job, Vin said, but Dai needs you at home. Mrs. Khan pushed away her plate, the eggs barely touched. She wouldn't take advice from someone whose marriage hadn't lasted more than 3 years. It's not about the money, Kevin. Vin sighed, for his mother only used his American name when she was upset with him. Maybe you should help Ba, he said, pointing to the front of his father's polo shirt, marred by a splash of hollandaise sauce. Look at this, the professor said, brushing at the stain with his fingers. It's only because you've upset me. Vin sighed once more, but Mrs. Khan refused to look at him as she dabbed a napkin in her glass of water. She wondered if he remembered their escape from Vongdao on a rickety fishing trawler, overloaded with his 5 siblings and 60 strangers, 3 years after the war's end. After the 4th day at sea, he and the rest of the children, bleached by the sun, were crying for water, even though there was none to offer but the seas. Nevertheless, she had washed their faces and combed their hair every morning, using salt water and spit. She was teaching them that decorum mattered even now, and that their mother's fear wasn't so strong that it could prevent her from loving them. Don't worry, she said. The stain will come out. As she leaned forward to scrub the professor's shirt, Mrs. Khan had a clear view of the painting. She liked neither the painting nor its gilded frame. It was too ornate for her taste, and seemed too old-fashioned for the painting. The disjuncture between the frame and the painting only exaggerated the painting's most disturbing feature, the way the woman's eyes looked forth from one side of her face. The sight of those eyes made Mrs. Khan so uneasy that later that day, after Vin went home, she moved the painting to the professor's library, where she left it facing a wall. It wasn't long after their son's visit that the professor stopped attending Sunday Mass. Mrs. Khan stayed home as well, and gradually they began seeing less and less of their friends. The only times she left the house were to go shopping or to the Garden Grove Library, where her fellow librarians knew nothing of the professor's illness. She enjoyed her part-time job, ordering and sorting the sizable collection of Vietnamese books and movies purchased for the residents of nearby Little Saigon, who, if they came to the library with a question, were directed to her perch behind the circulation desk. Answering those questions, Mrs. Khan always felt the gratification that made her job worthwhile, the pleasure of being needed, if only for a brief amount of time. When her shift ended at noon and she gathered her things to go home, she always did so with a sense of dread that shamed her. She made up for her shame by bidding goodbye to the other librarians with extra cheer, and by preparing the house for emergencies with great energy, as if she could forestall the inevitable through hard work. She marked a path from bed to bathroom with fluorescent yellow tape so the professor wouldn't get lost at night. And, on the wall across from the toilet, she taped a sign at eye level that said, "Flush." She composed a series of lists which, posted strategically around the house, reminded the professor what order to put his clothes on, what to put in his pockets before he left home, and what times of the day he should eat. But it was the professor who hired a handyman to install iron bars on the windows. You wouldn't want me sneaking out at night, the professor said with resignation, leaning his forehead against the bars. And neither would I. For Mrs. Khan, the more urgent problem was the professor coming home as a stranger. Whereas her husband was never one to be romantic, this stranger returned from one of the afternoon walks he insisted on taking by himself with a red rose in a plastic tube. He'd never before bought flowers of any sort, preferring to surprise her with more enduring presents, like the books he gave her every now and again, on topics like how to make friends and influence people, or income tax preparation. Once, he had surprised her by giving her fiction, a collection of short stories by an author she had never heard of before. Even this effort was slightly off the mark, for she preferred novels. She never read past the title pages of his gifts, satisfied at seeing her name penned in his elegant hand beneath those of the authors. But if the professor had spent his life practicing calligraphy, he'd never given a thought to presenting roses, and when he bowed while offering her the flower, he appeared to be suffering from a stomach cramp. "Who's this for?" she asked. "Is there anyone else here?" The professor shook the rose for emphasis, and one of its petals, browning at the edges, fell off. "It's for you." "It's very pretty." She took the rose reluctantly. "Where did you get it?" "Mr. Esteban. He tried selling me oranges also, but I said we had our own." "And who am I?" she demanded. "What's my name?" He squinted at her. "Ian, of course." "Of course." Biting her lip, she fought the urge to snap the head off the rose. She displayed the flower in a vase on the dining table for the professor's sake, but by the time she brought out dinner an hour later, he had forgotten he bought it. As he nibbled on blackened tiger shrimp, grilled on skewers, and tofu shimmering in black bean sauce, he talked animatedly instead about the postcard they'd received that afternoon from their eldest daughter, working for American Express in Munich. Mrs. Kine examined the picture of the Marienplatz before turning over the postcard to read aloud the note, which remarked on the curious absence of pigeons. "Little things stay with you when you travel," observed the professor, sniffing at the third course, a soup of bitter melon. Their children had never acquired the taste for it, but it reminded the professor and Mrs. Kahn of their own childhood. "Such as?" "The price of cigarettes," the professor said. "When I returned to Saigon after finishing my studies, I couldn't buy my daily Gauloises any longer. The imported price was too much." She leaned the postcard against the vase, where it would serve as a memento of the plans they'd once made for traveling to all of the world's great cities after their retirement. The only form of transport Mrs. Kahn had ruled out was the ocean cruise. Open expanses of water prompted fears of drowning, a phobia so strong that she no longer took baths, and even when showering, kept her back to the spray. "Now, why did you buy that?" the professor asked. "The postcard?" "No, the rose." "I didn't buy it." Mrs. Kahn chose her words carefully, not wanting to disturb the professor too much, and yet wanting him to know what he had done. "You did." "Me?" The professor was astonished. "Are you certain?" "I am absolutely certain," she said, surprised to hear the gratification in her voice. The professor didn't notice. He only sighed and took out the blue notebook from the pocket of his shirt. "Well, let's hope that won't happen again," he muttered. "I don't suppose it will." Mrs. Kahn stood to gather the dishes. She hoped her face didn't show her anger, convinced as she was that the professor had intended the rose for this other woman. She was carrying four plates, the tureen, and both their glasses when, at the kitchen's threshold, the wobbling weight of her load became too much. The sound of silverware clattering on the tiled floor and the smash of porcelain breaking made the professor cry out from the dining room. "What's that?" he shouted. Mrs. Kahn stared at the remains of the tureen at her feet. Three uneaten green coins of bitter melon stuffed with pork lay sodden on the floor among the shards. "It's nothing," she said. "I'll take care of it." After he'd fallen asleep later that evening, she went to his library, where the painting she had propped by his desk was now turned face forward. She sighed. If he kept turning the painting this way, she would at least have to reframe it in something more modern and suitable. She sat down at his desk, flanked on either side by bookshelves that held several hundred volumes in Vietnamese, French, and English. His ambition was to own more books than he could ever possibly read, a desire fueled by having left behind all his books when they had fled Vietnam. Dozens of paperbacks cluttered his desk, and she had to shove them aside to find the notebooks where he'd been tracking his mistakes over the past months. He had poured salt into his coffee and sprinkled sugar into his soup. When a telemarketer had called, he'd agreed to 5-year subscriptions to Guns and Ammo and Cosmopolitan. And one day, he'd tucked his wallet in the freezer, giving new meaning to the phrase, cold, hard cash, or so he joked with her when she discovered it. But there was no mention of Ian, and after a moment's hesitation, underneath his most recent entry, Mrs. Kahn composed the following. "Today, I called my wife by the name of Ian," she wrote. She imitated the flourishes of the professor's penmanship with great care, pretending that what she was doing was for the professor's own good. This mistake must not be repeated. The following morning, the professor held forth his coffee cup and said, "Please pass me the sugar, Ian." The next day, as she trimmed his hair in the bathroom, he asked, "What's on television tonight, Ian?" As he called her by the other woman's name again and again over the following weeks, the question of who this woman was consumed her days. Perhaps Ian was a childhood crush, or a fellow student of his graduate school years in Marseille, or even a second wife in Saigon, someone he'd visited on the way home from the university during those long, early evening hours when he told her he was sitting in his office on campus correcting student exams. She recorded every incident of mistaken identity in his notebooks, but the next morning he would read her forgeries without reaction, and not long after would call her Ian once more, until she thought she might burst into tears if she heard that name again. The woman was most likely a fantasy found by the professor's wandering mind, or so she told herself after catching him naked from the waist down, kneeling over the bathtub and scrubbing furiously at his pants and underwear under a jet of hot water. Glaring over his shoulder, the professor had screamed,
"Get out!"
She jumped back, slamming the bathroom door in her haste. Never before had the professor lost such control of himself or yelled at her, not even in those first days after coming to Southern California, when they'd eaten from food stamps, gotten housing assistance, and worn secondhand clothes donated by the parishioners of St. Albans. That was true love, she thought. Not giving roses, but going to work every day, and never once complaining about teaching Vietnamese to so-called heritage learners, immigrant and refugee students who already knew the language, but merely wanted an easy grade. Not even during the most frightening time of her life, when they were lost on the great azure plain of the sea, rolling unbroken to the horizon, did the professor raise his voice. By the fifth evening, the only sounds besides the waves slapping at the hull were children whimpering and adults praying to God, Buddha, and their ancestors. The professor hadn't prayed. Instead, he had stood at the ship's bow as if he was at his lectern, the children huddled together at his knees for protection against the evening wind, and told them lies. "You can't see it even in daylight," he'd said, "but the current we're traveling on is going straight to the Philippines, the way it's done since the dawn of time." He repeated his story so often even she allowed herself to believe it, until the afternoon of the seventh day, when they saw, in the distance, the rocky landing strip of a foreign coast. Nesting upon it were the huts of a fishing village, seemingly composed of twigs and grass, brooded over by a fringe of mangroves. At the sight of land, she had thrown herself into the professor's arms, knocking his glasses askew, and sobbed openly for the first time in front of her startled children. She was so seized by the ecstasy of knowing that they would all live that she had blurted out, "I love you." It was something she had never said in public and hardly ever in private. And the professor, embarrassed by their children's giggles, had only smiled and adjusted his glasses. His embarrassment only deepened once they reached land, which the locals informed them was the north shore of eastern Malaysia. For some reason, the professor never spoke of this time at sea, although he referred to so many other things they had done in the past together, including events of which she had no recollection. The more she listened to him, the more she feared her own memory was faltering. Perhaps they really had eaten ice cream flavored with durian on the veranda of a tea plantation in the Central Highlands, reclining on rattan chairs. And was it possible they'd fed bamboo shoots to the tame deer in the Saigon Zoo? Or together had beaten off a pickpocket, a scabby refugee from the bombed-out countryside who'd snuck up on them in the Bintang Market? As the days of spring lengthened into summer, she answered the phone less and less, eventually turning off the ringer so the professor wouldn't answer calls either. She was afraid that if someone asked for her, he would say, "Who?" Even more worrying was the prospect of him speaking to their friends, or children, of Ian. When her daughter phoned from Munich, she said, "Your father's not doing so well," but left the details vague. She was more forthcoming with Vin, knowing that whatever she told him, he would email to the other children. Whenever he left a message, she could hear the hiss of grease in a pan, or the chatter of a news channel, or the beeping of horns. He only called her on his cell phone as he did something else. She admitted that as much as she loved her son, she liked him very little. A confession that made her unhappy with herself until the day she called him back and he asked, "Have you decided? Are you going to quit? Don't make me tell you one more time." She wrapped the telephone cord tightly around her index finger. "I'm never going to quit." After she hung up the phone, she returned to the task of changing the sheets the professor had bedwet the previous evening. Her head was aching from lack of sleep, her back was sore from the chores, and her neck was tight with worry. When bedtime came, she was unable to sleep, listening to the professor talk about how gusts of the mistral blew him from one side to the other of the winding narrow streets of Le Panier, where he'd lived in a basement apartment during his Marseille years, or about the hypnotic sound made by the scratch of 100 pens on paper as students took their exams. As he talked, she studied the dim light in their bedroom, cast off from the street lamps outside, and remembered how the moon over the South China Sea was so bright that even at midnight she could see the fearful expressions on her children's faces. She was counting the cars passing by outside, listening for the sounds of their engines and hoping for sleep, when the professor touched her hand in the dark. "If you close your eyes," he said gently, "you might hear the ocean." Mrs. Kan closed her eyes. September came and went. October passed and the Santa Ana winds came, rushing from the mountains to the east with the force of freeway traffic, breaking the stalks of the Egyptian papyruses she'd planted in ceramic pots next to the trellis. She no longer allowed the professor to walk by himself in the afternoons, but instead followed him discreetly by 10 or 20 feet, clutching her hat against the winds. If the Santa Anta had subsided, they read together on the patio. Over the past few months, the professor had taken to reading out loud and slowly. Each day he seemed to read even more loudly and more slowly, until the afternoon in November, when he stopped in mid-sentence for so long that the silence shook Mrs. Kan from the grip of Gwyn Dow's latest romance. "What's the matter?" she asked, closing her book. "I've been trying to read this sentence for 5 minutes," the professor said, staring at the page. When he looked up, she saw tears in his eyes. "I'm losing my mind, aren't I?" From then on, she read to him whenever she was free, from books on academic topics she had no interest in whatsoever. She stopped whenever he began reciting a memory. The anxiety he felt on meeting her father for the first time, while she waited in the kitchen to be introduced. The day of their wedding when he nearly fainted from the heat and the tightness of his cravat. Or the day they returned to Saigon 3 years ago and visited their old house on Phan Thanh Yan, which they could not find at first because the street had been renamed Dien Bien Phu. Saigon had also changed names after it changed hands, but they couldn't bring themselves to call it Ho Chi Minh City. Neither could the taxi driver who ferried them from their hotel to the house, even though he was too young to remember a time when the city was officially Saigon. They parked 2 houses down from their old house and stayed in the taxi to avoid the revolutionary cadres from the north who had moved in after the communist takeover. She and the professor were nearly overwhelmed by sadness and rage, fuming as they wondered who these strangers were who had taken such poor care of their house. The solitary alley lamp illuminated tears of rust streaking the walls, washed down from the iron grill of the terrace by the monsoon rain. As the taxi's wipers squeaked against the windshield, a late-night masseur biked past, announcing his calling with a shake of a glass bottle filled with pebbles. "You told me it was the loneliest sound in the world," said the professor. Before he started talking, she'd been reading to him from a biography of de Gaulle, and her finger was still on the last word she'd read. She didn't like to think about their lost home, and she didn't remember having said any such thing. "The wipers or the glass bottle?" she asked. "The bottle." "And it seemed so at the time," she lied. "I hadn't heard that sound in years." "We heard it often. In Dalat." The professor took off his glasses and wiped them with his handkerchief. He had gone once to a resort in the mountains of Dalat for a conference while she stayed in Saigon, pregnant. "You always wanted to eat your ice cream outside in the evenings," the professor continued. "But it's hard to eat ice cream in the tropics, Ian. One has no time to savor it, unless one is indoors, with air conditioning. Dairy products give you indigestion. If one eats ice cream in a bowl, it rapidly becomes soup. If one eats it in a cone, it melts all over one's hand." When he turned to her and smiled, she saw gumdrops of mucus in the corners of his eyes. "Oh, you love those brown sugar cones, Ian. You insisted that I hold yours for you so your hand wouldn't get sticky." A breeze rattled the bougainvillea. The first hint, perhaps, of the Santa Ana returning. The sound of her own voice shocked her as well as the professor, who stared at her with his mouth agape when she said, "That's not my name. I am not that woman, whoever she is, if she even exists." "Oh?" The professor slowly closed his mouth and put his glasses back on. "Your name isn't Ian?" "No," she said. "Then what is it?" She wasn't prepared for the question, having only been worried about her husband calling her by the wrong name. They rarely used each other's proper names, preferring endearments like An for him or Am for her, and when they spoke to each other in front of the children, they called themselves Ba and Ma. Usually, she heard her first name spoken only by friends, relatives, or bureaucrats, or when she introduced herself to someone new, as she was, in a sense, doing now. "My name is Sa," she said. "I am your wife." "Right." The professor licked his lips and took out his notebook. That evening, after they had gone to bed and she heard him breathing evenly, she switched on her lamp and reached across his body for the notebook propped on the alarm clock. His writing had faded into such a scribble that she was forced to read what he wrote twice, following the jags and peaks of his letters down a dog-eared page until she reached the bottom, where she deciphered the following. Matters worsening. Today, she insisted I call her by another name. Must keep closer eye on her. Here she licked her finger and used it to turn the page, for she may not know who she is anymore. She closed the book abruptly with a slap of the pages, but the professor, curled up on his side, remained still. A scent of sweat and sulfur emanated from underneath the sheets. If it wasn't for his quiet breathing and the heat of his body, he might have been dead. And for a moment, as fleeting as deja vu, she wished he really were. In the end, there was no choice. On her last day at work, her fellow librarians threw her a surprise farewell party, complete with cake and a wrapped gift box that held a set of travel guides for the vacations they knew she'd always wanted to take. She fondled the guides for a while, riffling through their pages, and when she almost wept, her fellow librarians thought she was being sentimental. Driving home with a box of guides in the back seat, next to a package of adult diapers she'd picked up from Savon's that morning, she fought to control the sense that ever so slowly, the book of her life was being closed. When she opened the door to their house and called out his name, she heard only bubbling from the fish tank. After not finding him in any of the bedrooms or bathrooms, she left the diapers and box of books in his library. An open copy of Sports Illustrated was on his recliner in the living room. A half-eaten jar of applesauce sat on the kitchen counter. And in the backyard, the chenille throw he wore around his lap in cool weather lay on the ground. Floating in his teacup on the patio table was a curled petal from the bougainvillea, shuttling back and forth. Panic almost made her call the police. But they wouldn't do anything so soon. They'd tell her to call back when he was missing for a day or two. As for Ben, she ruled him out, not wanting to hear him say, "I told you so." Regret swept over her then, a wave of feeling born from her guilt over being so selfish. Her librarian's instinct for problem-solving and orderly research kept her standing under the weight of that regret, and she returned to her car determined to find the professor. She drove around her block first before expanding in ever-widening circles. The windows rolled down on both sides. The neighborhood park, where she and the professor often strolled, was abandoned except for squirrels chasing each other through the branches of an oak tree. The sidewalks were empty of pedestrians or joggers, except for a withered man in a plaid shirt standing on a corner, selling roses from plastic buckets and oranges from crates, his eyes shaded by a grimy baseball cap. When she called him Mr. Esteban, his eyes widened. When she asked him if he'd seen the professor, he smiled apologetically and said, "No hablo inglés, lo siento." Doubling back on her tracks, she drove each street and lane and cul-de-sac a second time. Leaning out the window, she called his name, first in a low voice, shy about making a scene, and then in a shout.
"Ancan!"
she cried.
"Ancan!"
A few window curtains twitched, and a couple of passing cars slowed down, their drivers glancing at her curiously. But he didn't spring forth from behind anyone's hedges or emerge from a stranger's door. Only after it was dark did she return. The moment she walked through the front door, she smelled the gas. The kettle was on the stove, but the burner hadn't been lit. Both her pace and her pulse quickened from a walk to a sprint. After shutting off the gas, she saw that the glass doors leading to the patio, which she'd closed before her departure, were slightly ajar. There was a heavy, long flashlight in one of the kitchen drawers, and the heft of the aluminum barrel in her hand was comforting as she slowly approached the glass doors. But when she shone the light over the patio and onto the garden, she saw only her persimmon trees and the red glint of the chilies. She was in the hallway when she saw the light spilling out of the professor's library. When she peeked around the door frame, she saw the professor with his back to the door. At his feet were her box of books, and he stood facing the bookshelf that was reserved for her. Here, she kept her magazines and the books he'd given her over the years. The professor knelt, picked a book from the box, and stood up to shelve it. He repeated the same motion, one book at a time. Hidden Tahiti and French Polynesia, Farmers Hawaii, National Geographic Traveler, the Caribbean. With each book he mumbled something she couldn't hear, as if he might be trying to read the titles on the spines. Essential Greek Islands. Jerusalem and the Holy Land. World Cultures, Japan. A Romantic's Guide to Italy. He touched the covers of each book with great care, tenderly, and she knew, not for the first time, that it wasn't she who was the love of his life. The professor shelved the last book and turned around. The expression on his face when he saw her was the one he'd worn 40 years ago at their first meeting, when she'd entered the living room of her father's house and seen him pale with anxiety, eyes blinking in anticipation. "Who are you?" he cried, raising his hand as if to ward off a blow. Her heart was beating fast and her breathing was heavy. When she swallowed, her mouth was dry, but she could feel a sheen of dampness on her palms. It struck her then that these were the same sensations she'd felt that first time, seeing him in a white linen suit wrinkled by high humidity, straw fedora pinned between hand and thigh. "It's just me," she said. "It's Ian." "Oh," the professor said, lowering his hand. He sat down heavily in his armchair, and she saw that his Oxfords were encrusted in mud. As she crossed the carpet to the bookshelf, he followed her with a hooded gaze, his look one of exhaustion. She was about to take Le Petit Rue de Paris from the bookshelf for the evening's reading, but when she saw him close his eyes and lean back in his armchair, it was clear that he wouldn't be traveling anywhere. Neither was she. Having ruled out the travel guides, she decided against the self-help books and how-to manuals as well. Then she saw the thin and uncracked spine of the book of short stories. A short story, she thought, would be just long enough. Sitting beside him on the carpet, she found herself next to the painting. She turned her back to the woman with the two eyes on one side of her face, and she promised herself that tomorrow she would have the painting reframed. When she opened the book, she could feel the woman looking over her shoulder at her name, written in his precise hand under that of the author's. She wondered what, if anything, she knew about love. Not much, perhaps, but enough to know that what she would do for him now, she would do again tomorrow, and the next day, and the day after that. She would read out loud, from the beginning. She would read with measured breath, to the very end. She would read as if every letter counted, page by page and word by word. The Americans. If it wasn't for his daughter and his wife, James Carver would never have ventured into Vietnam, a country about which he knew next to nothing except what it looked like at 40,000 feet. But Michiko had insisted on visiting after Claire invited them, her email addressed to Mom and Dad, but really meant for her mother. Michiko was the one who wanted to see Vietnam, hearing from relatives who had toured there that it reminded them of Japan's bucolic past, before General MacArthur wielded the post-war hand of Reconstruction to daub Western makeup on Japanese features. Carver, however, cared little for pastoral fantasies, his childhood passed in a rural Alabama hamlet siphoned clean of hope long before his birth. He had refused to go until Michiko compromised, proposing Angkor Wat as the prelude and Thailand's beaches and temples as the postscript to a brief Vietnamese sojourn. This was how Carver found himself in September in Hue, walking slowly through the grounds of an imperial tomb with Michiko, Claire, and her boyfriend, Coy Legaspi. Legaspi's optimism and serenity irked Carver, as did the poor fit between Legaspi's Asian appearance and his surname, bestowed on him by his adoptive parents. The young man, perhaps sensing his ambivalence, had been solicitous of him throughout his visit, but Carver found Legaspi's attention patronizing rather than helpful. Before embarking on their tour through the imperial tombs this morning, for example, Legaspi had attempted to sympathize with Carver by mentioning how his own father was forced to walk with a cane. "That's worse than your situation," Legaspi said. The comment irritated Carver, implying as it did that he was somehow whining about having broken his hip 3 years ago when he had fallen down the stairway of his own house. Now he was 68 and limping, determined not to be outpaced by Legaspi as he led them through the grounds of the tomb, which more closely resembled a summer palace, its pavilion overlooking a moat filled with lotuses. I might go back and finish my doctorate, Legaspi said, in response to a question from Michiko. Fit and slender in khakis and a burnt orange polo shirt, he resembled the college students at Bowdoin whom Carver saw loitering on the sidewalks whenever he drove to town. But maybe not. I suppose after a while, the pure research was not enough. I wanted to apply the research. I'd love to see your robot in action. Michiko brushed her hand against the mossy flank of a millennium-old wall, varnished black by the centuries. The royal past alluded to was nowhere near as grand as Buckingham Palace or Versailles, which Carver had seen during layovers on the European routes he had piloted for Pan Am. But the tomb had its own melancholic charm. And the mongoose. How about the day after tomorrow, Legaspi said. I can set up a demonstration. What do you think, Dad? Carver saw once again the crow's feet around Claire's eyes, newly engraved since her departure for Vietnam 2 years ago. She was only 26. It'll be educational. Angkor Wat was pretty educational. Carver didn't like being educated on his vacations. And we visited that terrible war museum in Saigon. I don't really feel like seeing any more horrors. What you'll see is the future of demining, Claire said. Not people crawling on their knees, digging out mines by hand. Won't this robot put those people out of work? That is not the kind of work people should do, Legaspi said. Robots were invented to free people from danger and slavery. Carver's ears twitched. You said the Department of Defense was funding your advisor's research at MIT. Why exactly do you think the DOD is interested in these robots? Dad, Claire said. We have to take money where we find it. Legaspi shrugged. The world isn't a pure place. Famous last words. Jimmy, said Michiko, all I'm saying is not to underestimate the military-industrial complex. I suppose you know, Claire said. How about a picture? Legaspi proposed. Carver groaned silently. He hated taking pictures, but Michiko loved commemorating every occasion, important or trivial. For her sake, he took his place obediently between his wife and daughter, who themselves were flanked by two gray stone mandarins, goateed and with swords on their shoulders. They were shorter even than Michiko and Claire, and Carver assumed they were life-size from the time of this emperor whose name he suddenly could not recall as Legaspi aimed the camera. It was true that this was the third tomb they were visiting on the Perfume River, but it still bothered Carver that he could not remember this emperor's name, which Legaspi had mentioned several times. Becoming stupider was a consequence of age for which he was unprepared. With age was supposed to come wisdom, but he wasn't certain what wisdom felt like, whereas intelligence he knew to be a constant firing of the synapses, the brain a six-barreled Gatling gun of activity. Now his mind was only shooting thoughts through one or two barrels. He hadn't been this slow since Claire and William were newborns, their nighttime neediness calling him from his sleep. Now his son was 28, and Carver dated the beginning of his decline to William's graduation from the Air Force Academy 6 years ago, one of the proudest moments in Carver's life. William had also become a pilot, but he was unhappy flying a KC-135, refueling bombers and fighters patrolling the skies of Iraq and Afghanistan. "It's boring, Dad," William had said over the phone during their last conversation. "I'm a truck driver." "Truck driving is good," Carver said. "Truck driving is honorable." Most importantly, flying a tanker was safe. Unlike Carver's own military years when he piloted a B-52, an ungainly blue whale of a plane that he loved with an intensity still felt as a lingering hunger. During different tours in the late 60s and early 70s, he launched from Guam, Okinawa, and Thailand, never finding himself freer than in the cockpit's tight squeeze, entrusted with a majestic machine carrying within its womb 30 tons of iron bombs, and yet for all that, vulnerable as a Greek demigod. Two bombers of his wing had collided with each other over the South China Sea, the bodies of the crews lost forever, while another B-52 in his cell was transformed into a flaming cross as it fell in the night sky, tail clipped by a surface-to-air missile, the two survivors spending the next 4 years in the Hanoi Hilton. Better to be safe, Carver wanted to tell William, but he refrained. William would hear the lie. As an airman, William knew that if his father could live life all over again, Carver wouldn't hesitate to crawl once more through the narrow breach in the paunch of the B-52's fuselage, the entry never failing to make him quiver with anticipation. The next morning, Claire hired a van to take her parents on the 2-hour ride to Guangzhou, where she was living and where Legaspi's demining operation was based. When Claire showed them her studio apartment, Carver was relieved to see only a twin-sized bed, shrouded behind a mosquito net. A window and narrow horizontal slits at the top of the high walls provided ventilation, the air pushed about by a ceiling fan that rotated as slowly as a chicken on a spit. The kitchen consisted of a heat-scarred, two-burner, portable gas stove on a countertop with black veins in the grouting, while the bathroom had no separate shower stall, only a drain in the floor next to the toilet, the showerhead on a hose. Posters of rock bands papered the walls above the cinder blocks and wood boards where Clara shelved her clothing. Dengue fever, death cab for cutie, hot, hot heat. "Couldn't you find a, better place, dear?" Michiko fanned herself with her sun hat. "You don't even have an air conditioner. This is better than what most people have. Even if people could afford this place, there'd be an entire family in here." "You're not a native," Carver said. "You're an American. That's a problem I'm trying to correct." Recalling a lesson from the couples therapy Michiko had persuaded him to attend, Carver counted down from 10. Claire watched with her arms crossed, face as impassive as it was when he spanked her in childhood or shouted at her in teenage years when she repeatedly crossed whatever line he'd drawn. "Enough, you two," Michiko said. "Everybody's a little cranky without their coffee, aren't they?" Claire's apartment was situated above a cafe. Carver sipped black coffee on ice at their sidewalk table, squatting on a plastic stool and watching Michiko spend $5 buying postcards and lighters from 4 barefoot children, dark as dust, who bounded up the moment they sat down. After their sales, the quartet retreated a few feet and stood with their backs to a row of parked motorbikes, giggling and staring. "Haven't they seen tourists before?" Carver said. "Not like us." Claire unsealed a pack of cigarettes and lit one. "We're a mixed bag." "They don't know what to make of us," Michiko said. "I'm used to it, but you're not. Try being a Japanese wife at a Michigan airbase in 1973. "Touché," Claire said. "Try being a black man in Japan," Carver said, "or Thailand." "But you could always go home," Claire said. "There was always a place for you somewhere, but there's never been a place for me." She said it matter-of-factly, without any of the melodrama of her adolescence, when she would come home from school sobbing at a slight from a peer or a stranger, some variation along the line of, "What are you?" Her tears agonized Carver, making him feel guilty for delivering her into a world determined to put everybody in her proper place. He wanted to find the culprit who had hurt his daughter and beat some sense into the kid's head, but he restrained himself, as he had whenever he encountered the look in people's eyes that said, "What are you doing here?" In the one-room library of the small town 5 miles down the road from his hamlet, at Penn State, which he attended on an ROTC scholarship, in flight school at Randolph Air Force Base, in an airman's uniform, in his B-52, and later his Boeing airliner, he was never where he was supposed to be. He had survived by focusing on his goal, ascending ever higher, refusing to see the sneers and doubt in his peripheral vision. But now, retired, limping out of his 60s, he no longer knew what his goal should be. He envied Claire her sense of mission, teaching English to people as poor as the dirt farmers and sharecroppers of his childhood, their skin as brown and cracked as the soil they tilled, the desiccated earth of summer's oppressive months. She exhibited a confidence that pleased him as he watched her hail a taxi, give directions in Vietnamese to the English school, and greet the students clustered in the courtyard under the shade of flame trees. When Claire gestured at Carver and Michiko and said something in the local language, the students greeted them in pitch-perfect English. "Hello! How are you? Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. Carver!" Carver smiled at them and waved back. Smiling at your relatives never got you very far, but smiling at strangers and acquaintances sometimes did. A few doors down the colonnade from the courtyard was Claire's classroom, her wooden desk confronting several rows of short tables and benches. Acne scars of white plaster were visible, the yellow paint of the walls having peeled away in a multitude of places. On the blackboard behind Claire's desk, someone, it must have been her, had written "The Passive Voice" in big, bold letters. Underneath was written, "My bicycle was stolen," and "Mistakes were made." "How many students do you have, dear?" Michiko said. 4 classes of 30 each." "That's too much," Carver said. "You're not paid enough to do that. They really want to learn, and I really want to teach." "So you've been here for 2 years." Carver towed a slab of tile flicking loose from the floor. "How much longer are you planning to stay?"
"Indefinitely."
"What do you mean, indefinitely?"
"I like it here, Dad."
"You like it here," Carver said. "Look at this place." Claire deliberately swept her gaze over her classroom.
"I'm looking."
"What your father means is that we want you back home because we love you."
"That's what I mean."
"I am home, Mom. It sounds strange, I don't know how to put it, but I feel like this is where I'm supposed to be. I have a Vietnamese soul."
"That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard," Carver shouted.
"It's not stupid," Claire hissed.
"Don't say that. You always say that."
"Name 3 times I've said that."
"When I left Maine for school."
Claire held up 3 fingers of her right hand and slowly curled each one into her palm as she counted the times, ending up with a balled fist.
"When I majored in women's studies. When I told you I was going to Vietnam to teach. And those are just the most recent ones to come to mind."
"But those things are stupid."
"Oh, God, God, God!"
Claire beat her fist on her forehead.
"Why do I ever think things will be different with you?"
"For Christ's sakes," Carver muttered. Whispering drew his attention to the door, where a handful of the students had clustered. Claire wiped tears from her eyes.
"Look, now you've made me lose face with them."
"Lose face?" Carver said.
"You really do think you're turning into one of them."
"Shut up, James." Michiko pushed by him to offer Claire a tissue.
"I think we've had just about enough family time together, don't you?"
While Claire escorted Michiko on a shopping expedition for local textiles, Carver was forced to entertain himself. A problem, since there was nothing to recommend Guangxi to the foreign visitor except its proximity to the old demilitarized zone. The city was just a provincial town that had been destroyed in the course of the war, and, from all reports, there had not been that much to see before its destruction. Carver passed the time sitting at a bar's sidewalk patio and watching local boys play soccer on a patch of grass. By the time the monsoon arrived in the afternoon, he had drunk enough 33 beer to remind himself that nothing had changed since he had drunk it in Thailand over 30 years ago.
"If you're going to bomb a country," his roommate in Utapau had said, "you should at least drink its beer."
It was insipid then, and it was insipid now. As curtains of rain swept over the road, he ordered a bottle of Huey instead. Watching the water flooding through the gutters, Carver longed for his clapboard cottage on the shore of Basin Cove, autumn waving its metamorphosing wand over the forest's greenery. That new world of crimson and gold receded even further when the lady who ran the market next to the bar turned up the volume of her radio. Above the relentless hammering of the rain, a high-pitched woman's voice whined in accompaniment with what sounded like a xylophone, the music pregnant with sorrow. Although perhaps it was only Carver who heard a lamentation where there was none. The demining site was half an hour from their hotel in Guangxi the next afternoon, far beyond the outskirts of the city. Legaspi had promised to pick them up in a white buffalo, and when Carver had asked him if he really meant a white buffalo, Legaspi had winked and said, "You'll see." The white buffalo turned out to be a white Toyota Land Cruiser speckled with measles of rust, its counter reading over 300,000 kilometers.
"Locals call these things white buffalo because they're as plentiful as white buffalo," Legaspi said from the driver's seat.
"The foreigners and the NGOs and the UN love the Land Cruiser."
"Donor money," Carver said. "All the donuts and four-wheel drives you can buy."
"Pretty much, Mr. Carver." Michiko and Claire sat in the back seat, Carver in the front. Lining the road outside of Guangxi were 1- and 2-story homes of faded wood and corrugated tin, a few freshly painted and plastered mini-mansions towering over their primitive neighbors, all of them long and narrow. Occasionally, a cemetery or a temple came into view, encrusted with dragonesque architectural filigree, as well as a couple of churches, their ascetic walls plain and whitewashed. The flat fields behind the homes were mostly vacant of trees and shade, some of the plots growing rice and the others devoted to crops Carver did not recognize. Their color, the dull, muted green of an algae bloom, the countryside nowhere near as lush and verdant as the Thai landscape visible from Carver's cockpit window as his B-52 ascended over the waters of Tali Sap Songkhla, destined for the enemy cities of the north or the Plain of Jars. There was a reason he loved flying. Almost everything looked more beautiful from a distance, the earth becoming ever more perfect as one ascended and came closer to seeing the world from God's eyes. Man's hovels and palaces disappearing, the peaks and valleys of geography fading to become strokes of a paintbrush on a divine sphere.
But seen up close from this height, the countryside was so poor that the poverty was neither picturesque nor pastoral. Tin-roofed shacks with dirt floors, a man pulling up the leg of his shorts to urinate on a wall, laborers wearing slippers as they pushed wheelbarrows full of bricks. When Carver rolled down his window, he discovered that the smell of the countryside was just as unpleasant, the air thick with blasts of soot